Desafinado, Discord, the theme music for our program Literary Discord. Discord because we try to avoid the usual focus on money, money, money and bestsellers, 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 to talk about the other world where serious literature and serious nonfiction comes to the fore. By the way, after having used this for a year, I think it's time to mention the composer of Desafinado. It's played, of course, by Stan Getz and Charlie Bird, but the composer is a man called Antonio Carlos Jobim. And for some mysterious reason, I've never met anybody who had heard of him, but he wrote his music. So Literary Discord, and this is our first program in the new year. Because of that, it's sort of a solemn moment, I want to start with something different. It is about 10 years ago that Don Hutter, who was a very prominent, excellent editor on the New York scene, and a friend of mine, and also my editor for several books, suddenly at an early age died. And not long before his death, he sent me an article or a letter which reacted to a letter of mine in which I had complained about the absence of serious professional book critics, or the scarcity of them. And it seems a proper thing to start a new year and to commemorate an excellent editor by reading you this letter from Don. And he says, thinking back over a 3-decade career as editor, of many books that could be said to fall under Hans Koenig's definition of serious novels, I venture to add a few afterthoughts. One of the curses he had identified as having fallen on such individualistic work, that is to say the absence of a professional school of critics in this country, this absence is less arguable today than it might have been 30 years ago. Though even then you could finger count those who fulfilled the role and responsibilities of a professional critic. Yet, granting this point, and indeed the breed is spotted more readily in the communities of American film and art, and always has been in British and European publishing, granting this, things have gotten worse, and largely so, it seems to me, because of the effect of commercialization within publishing itself. Koenig takes a fatalistic approach to this more usually identified culprit. And in one sense, he is right. Commercial publishers still publish serious writers. I grant him that point, and I will even apply his angle of vision. But to bring the onus back on the telling factors of my own experience in serious or literary publishing, as opposed to consciously commercial publishing. I agree, Don Hutter writes, that book reviewers trying to fill the vacuum of professional criticism exhibit no reliable or literarily responsible standards for effectively promoting new works of serious fiction. That fault is symptomatic of the cavalier and, yes, the commercial practices of review organs, that is, of those magazines with readerships large enough for a perceptive reviewer's enthusiasm, making a commercial difference for a book. Space is inordinately limited in our cultural journals for even hope of such reviews. Abysmally paid auxiliaries are used for roundups or, quote, also published, unquote, snippets that do no one any good. And in those few review publications that do offer ample individual space and intelligent criticism, the premium is increasingly on nonfiction, or a novelist already secure in the eyes of the publication's beholders. Is this all new? Not really. The New York Times Book Review, the main hope in this country for serious novel being effectively reviewed, was guilty of the same practices or non-practices in the 60s. Back then, there was hardly more fertile ground around the TBR, the Times Book Review, than exists today. Is it worse? Decidedly. Why? 3 reasons. First of all, 3 or 4 times as many books are being published for essentially the same reviewing capacity. 2, the acceptability, if you will, of new serious fiction is more determined than ever by trends of social realism. I must interject here my own voice. I'm coning again. I must admit I don't quite follow Don Hutter here in this trance of social realism, but those are his words, and I give them as he wrote them. At some other program, I hope to be able to come back to this subject. The third reason is that a huge gap has opened in publishing priorities and performance between books perceived as commercialist and those published with, at best, wistful hope of notices good enough to satisfy a publisher's prestige quotient. The last is the most profoundly operating factor, I believe. It used to be that in-house predeterminants of publishing success, authors' advances, first printings, promotional budgets, were more or less running an even course from lowest to highest over a seasonal list, and those books more dependent on quality considerations than on marketing handles or an author's track record were given a fighting chance of mid-list placement. Now, practically speaking, there is no mid-list. The upper strata of well-published books, well-published between quotes, soar ever higher for those houses determined to stay in the thick of the competition. Mega agents with the declared secret of success manipulate publishers to the highest possible advances, seven figures not uncommon, with the aim not so much of phenomenal money for their clients as of placing the publisher in so deep a hole that he is obliged, self-interest-wise, to, quote, publish well, unquote. At the other end, while the printing of under 10,000 copies was once a fairly standard and by no means degrading circumstance, today it is virtually a death knell. So then, since publishing is and always has been a business of self-fulfilling prophecies, the knell tolls on over house staff, subsidiary rights interests, and book trade. Its final peals rung all too soon over an ignoring or ignorant reviewing establishment. So far, Don Hutter, editor and friend of every writer in New York, I think, who was serious, who died 10 years ago. I am now turning to my guest of today, who is David Kirkpatrick. He is a media news reporter for the New York Times, and he has created considerable interest and a certain amount of ups and downs of feelings in the book world by some very thoroughly researched major articles in the New York Times, one about discounts and their future, and another about the usual things that we hear a lot about these days, of course, the electronic book, the print-on-demand book, and the book which is electronically by telephone put on a screen, and you can use the same screen for any book you want to read, which is on file in the central computer. My first question to Kirkpatrick will be about discounts, because they play a considerable role in the future of books. Traditionally, the big stores have worked with very considerable discounts, especially for bestsellers, and the small bookstores have felt that this was an unfair advantage because they can't afford to do this, and this was supposedly one of the blows with which the big bookstore would fell and knock to the ground the small bookstores, although it hasn't really quite come out that way. So my first question is of David Kirkpatrick to elaborate on the problem of discounts.
Beginning in about 1985, when B. Dalton and Walden Books, and especially Crown Books, were rolling out stores across the country and competing intensely to gain market share in the book market, they were all discounting very aggressively and hacking away at the prices not just of their best-selling books, but in many cases, all books. And the tide has turned away from that. More recently, when Amazon.com began opening for business, they took it to an even greater extent, discounting all of their books and discounting their bestsellers especially heavily at about 50% off the cover price. Booksellers usually pay the book publisher about 50% of the cover price. So when they were taking that kind of a discount, they were essentially giving away all of their margin. And a lot of people scoffed and said they knew it couldn't last, and now it hasn't lasted. A little while ago, Amazon started pulling back its discounts, so it now discounts its bestsellers only 40% off, hardcover books only 30% off, paperbacks only 20% off, and that means that when you add in their shipping charges, which they also gradually raised over the same period, a lot of books are no longer cheaper online than they would be in stores. Meanwhile, in the big bookstore chains, they've also quietly begun pulling back their discounts. And the reasons for this are various. I mean, it could be that real estate, they say that real estate costs are higher. Could also be that the landscape has gotten less competitive because everyone has staked out their place. But for one reason or another, you used to be able to walk into a Barnes & Noble, for example, and see that all hardcover books were discounted 10 or 20% off. And in many places, all trade paperback books, or about half of their trade paperback books anyway, were about 10% off. And that is no longer the case. Now they're discounting only about, you know, a few hundred books in each store.
Yes, I understood that the sort of the general discount all along the line was sort of basically to get people into the store. And then the bestseller discount, of course, was something they thought they could afford, the big change, that is, because they have a guaranteed large sale. Oddly enough, we had the R.J. Julia bookstore, the R.J. Julia bookstore manager here, our owner, Roxanne Cody. So her point was that in general, if a product sells very well, the price may be raised by the retail people. And the fact that bestsellers are discounted seemed to be her sort of against nature almost. But my understanding is that if a book is printed in very large numbers, the price per copy for the printing is, of course, is much less than if you have to print a lot of books in small numbers. Isn't that the correct way to look at it?
Well, printing costs are really a little bit of a red herring because, in fact, the cost of printing a book is low and has been going down. It's only it's a couple dollars a copy, perhaps, for a hardcover book. The real cost in publishing a book is in the editing and especially the marketing costs. And for some of those big blockbusters, publishers are going to put a lot of money into marketing those books, you know, taking out ads on the back of the New York Times Book Review or even on the subways. And things like that. And that's where the real cost is. For a bookstore, it makes sense to discount the bestsellers because that's what brings people into those are the most high-profile books, and it's the best way to get people into the stores, even though, in fact, it turns out to be a relatively small portion of any bookstore's business. But you get somebody in there to buy the latest Nicholas Sparks volume, and then he picks up a calendar for his wife and a paperback that he wanted to read on the way, and soon you're in business. This was Len Riggio, who founded Barnes & Noble. This was one of his great insights when he was running one bookstore on Fifth Avenue in New York City that later grew to his giant chain.
I don't know if you have dealt with the whole business in European settings, you know, the fixed price business, which France had left abandoned, and now has come back to it again. I understand that the bookseller obliges himself not to go more than 5% off the jacket price. I can see the reasons. I can also see that I would assume that this is not something that would go over very well in the United States.
Yeah, that kind of practice really seems antithetical to American culture. We like to think that prices are unregulated. What's interesting in the European context, a couple things that are interesting about what's happening over there, and especially in Germany, where this is a real hot-button issue right now, fixed pricing on books. The first point I wanted to make is that the internet book selling has evolved in a very different way in Germany. I think something near half of all books sold on the internet now in Germany are sold through book websites associated with local bookstores. People like to buy a book from the website of their local bookstore and pick it up at the store, which is very different from the way things have gone in the U.S. And that gets to the second point, which is that internet book selling is a big challenge to fixed price book selling, because with the internet it's very easy to buy from a website located in another country, and it gets much, much harder to enforce fixed prices. Plus, there's a lot of pressure from internet booksellers who may have lower real estate costs because they don't have stores but have higher shipping costs to make it up by discounting the books and try to attract business that way.
The most not outlandish but the most startling suggestion on this program has been made by a well-known bookseller, and he said, well, actually, there's a woman, she said that she was in favor of making bookstores non-profit institutions. Do you want to say something about that?
I don't really see the point of that. I know a lot of independent booksellers complain that their business isn't as profitable as they would like it to be, but that's true of a lot of small business people. Some people feel like, I mean, books are different. Books occupy a very special place in our culture. But for years and years and years, bookstores have gotten by selling books and made plenty of money. And over the last two decades, the amount of store space devoted to selling books in this country has exploded. It's gone up astronomically, and so has the number of books available around the country in more locations than ever before. So although it might be uncomfortable for small booksellers, the world is definitely not any worse a place for readers.
Agree with the impression more, an anecdote more than a statistic, that even the largest bookstores where you sort of floors and floors of books, I've had it in England especially, but here too, that one is surprised to find how little there actually is. I mean, how often it happens that a book you want to buy, that not only have they never heard of it probably, but anyway, it's not in store. Somehow there is an element of disappointment built in. Do you agree with that?
Yes, but I think it's been ever thus. There's just a heck of a lot of books, and people being people, we inevitably want to read obscure books, and they're not around. You know, there's just no way that the biggest bookstore you could possibly imagine could have all the books that you or I would want to read. Happily, we now have internet bookstores, which have done a really brisk business in those truly obscure books, the books that are very hard to find.
Well, I was also specifically thinking of what's the unfortunate term, the classics, sort of the great novels of the last 200 years. They somehow seem to have virtually vanished from our stores and even from our libraries, except, of course, university libraries.
What kind of classics do you mean?
Well, say Stendhal Complete and even Trollope Complete. The books one feels they're ruined for a young man in the schools, I think, because once you have to read a book for a paper, then the pleasure is gone for the rest of your life, I think. But there's a lot of stuff which is still absolutely marvelous, and not because it's so noble to read this or such an effort. It's just they're very easy to read, and you do not find them. And I find also that in the large bookstores in general, the people who sell the books have never heard of them. I had a strange experience, which I must repeat, I won't name the store. I asked for a book of by Oscar Wilde, and the salesman said, "Well, we have something with Thornton Wilder," which seemed sort of typical for not very a learned approach to the whole thing.
Well, yes, as far as the classics, my impression is that they're still widely available in a lot of bookstores. Publishers feel that they do very well for themselves by publishing classics. And another nice thing about the classics is that because there are no copyrights, there's often price competition between more than one publisher, so they're available at a pretty low price. But in terms of the competence of the salespeople, that's definitely an issue. When the world of bookselling was dominated by small booksellers, it was much more likely that the owner was going to be present within earshot of anyone who's trying to buy a book, and you just can't have that in a superstore. And wages being what they are, you're not going to get a lot of really qualified people, and it's very hard for the even if there is a clerk who knows a lot about classical fiction, that might not be the clerk who you meet when you come in the door. You might be the clerk who knows a lot about photography. An interesting point that Leonard Riggio, the chairman of Barnes & Noble, made when I interviewed him about installing internet kiosks in all his stores is that he hoped that would allow the clerks to serve the customers better, because when you approach a clerk and you say, "I'm interested in one of George Eliot's minor works," the clerk can now go to the computer and look up the New York Review of Books catalog of recommended books and come back to you with an answer that reflects this database. So it enriches the resources that the clerks have to offer the customers.
Now for something completely different. It's not that different. I mean, the superstores, which have been so looked at askance by many book lovers, although I don't share that particular feeling, they may now have met their own Waterloo in the new technology, which you recently wrote about in the New York Times in great length. And I must say, it is rather hard to really grasp it for somebody who is virtually a computer illiterate, which is my generation. Can you sum up the situation in 100 words or 1,000 words?
I assume you're talking about digital books or electronic books. The most important thing to understand is that for the last few decades, book sales have gone up very, very slowly. Book sales growth has really been anemic. And so everybody in the industry, from bookstores to book publishers to authors, would love for there to be something that will give the market a shot in the arm, the way the first paperbacks did in the 1930s or the way the first trade paperbacks did in the 1950s, when suddenly there's a whole new market. There's a new kind of book, a new price point. It draws new consumers and allows you to sell books in new places in new ways. So now along come two different kinds of technology, one of them being computers, where you can read books on a screen, and the other being new printing technology, so that you can print books from digital files, literally whole books bound with even hardcovers in just a matter of minutes, relatively cheaply. They're both a little bit different. The print-on-demand, the instant printing technology, that has obvious repercussions for a lot of people in the book industry, because it means that low-selling books can be kept in stock more profitably. So it's good news for authors who used to see their books go out of print. It's good news for publishers who can make a little bit of money off of books that are at the margins of what they can sell. That's sort of good news all around. The intriguing thing is the idea of reading books on a screen. Nobody really knows whether that's going to work out or not. Most people have no real desire to read books on a screen. It seems intuitively awkward.
Yeah, I think you wrote actually that there's, as far as you know, nobody has ever read a whole book on the screen. It seems very funny.
Well, some people have read whole books on a screen, but chances are they work for a software company.
I see. It also struck me, what I grasped from it, the books that sort of have the best chance to be important in this field are really not the traditional books you read in bed or whatever. They're catalogs and maps, books of maps and other various info. It's more info than literature that seems to be used for this.
Well, that's a real head-scratcher. Nobody really knows what the market is going to be like for digital books that you download and read on a screen. As I say, everybody hopes they're going to be the new paperbacks. But who knows what people really want to read? The early indications are that, maybe a little bit counterintuitively, the two kinds of readers who are interested in books on a screen are the educational and professional market that you talked about, but also at what we normally think of as the bottom end of the market, people who read romances, science fiction, detective stories, genre fiction, the kind of stuff that you might buy for $5 in a drugstore and then throw away. Those kinds of people are really addicted to good, fast-paced narratives. They just want it as fast as they can get it, and they don't want to keep it around. It's not a book you want to have on your bookshelf. And those kinds of people, there's a small market already for readers of romance novels who just want to download the book and read it on their computer screen.
It was an illustration with your article where you once saw a sort of thing that you could hold in your hands and it looked almost like a book. Is that just radio-like, or is it connected to a cable or to an outlet? That wasn't quite clear.
Those devices are made by Thomson under the RCA brand, and the idea is that you plug it in to a phone line, and it connects to their central database computer server via the phones. What they like about that device is that the book you're downloading into your machine doesn't pass through a computer or over the Internet, which they think makes it more secure.
Have you actually yourself seen what kind of image those machines produce?
I've played with them a little bit. I have to say I haven't read a whole book on a screen either. But they look, you know, if I was going on the road and I didn't want to carry a lot of books with me, I might take one of those.
You mean you read a page and then you press a button or whatever and you read the next page?
Yep.
So you can't sort of leave back to a preceding chapter?
No, they have all kinds of bells and whistles where you can search around and look for particular passages in the book and go back there. It's pretty easy to navigate through.
Is it the same color, the same image as a computer screen?
It's a little bit better than what you see on your typical desktop computer screen.
Isn't there somehow, I don't know if I'm original on this, is somehow that people look for a solution to something which the problem isn't there, but the solution is already there? Aren't books as such well-nigh perfect items?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. No doubt about it. Nobody's complaining about books. Everybody thinks books are great. You never walk into a bookstore and say, God, this is such a drag. But publishers would love to change that. They would love to have another product to sell. So that's where we are now, and that's why there's so much noise about electronic books in the industry.
There's another thing which is a riddle to me. Much more important than anything is ever more important than it even was not 10 years ago, distribution, publicity, and this sort of setup where you have to order a book to be printed for you. Who would advertise it? Who would even make people aware of the availability of all these books?
Well, that's the key value that a publisher adds to the author's work, is publicizing it, getting attention for it, and that's not going to go away. That's still going to be very, very important. But you and I were just talking a moment ago about obscure books that you or I remember because they're classics, because nobody needs to go out and advertise Stendhal. And occasionally you can't find them in a bookstore. Now you'll be able to.
That was David Kirkpatrick, who was my guest today on Literary Discord. He's the media reporter for the New York Times, and we talked about the various problems of discounts and of electronic books. Actually, we were talking in the Donnell Library, which is not far from his office. You also heard the words of Don Hutter, editor and friend, who died some 10 years ago, and in his last year wrote me a letter about book publishing, and specifically about the review apparatus, as which works or doesn't work too well. And it seemed an appropriate and nice thing to start a new series for the new year by reading you his letter and his very thoughtful words. Thank you for listening to Literary Discord. We will be back in February, the 22nd of February, the fourth Thursday of that month. I am Hans Koning, and the producer of the program is Scott Harris.